a podcast of the cinema.
Your name's Alonzo Duralde. The editor of reviews at therap.com. My name is
Dave White. You are a film critic at The Wrap and other places, and we are both the hosts of this podcast. We're film critics. We're married.
And we have a guest.
People, I think, maybe who are occasional or even frequent listeners might think that friend and neighbor Gary Cotti is a character we made up. Like this was some wacky morning zoo crew, you know.
I think, though, that if they've listened to it for a very long time.
Yes.
They might remember years ago the episode where we sat at the old rickety, squeaky, ratchety dining room table.
Oh.
While he, 10 feet away, built the table that we are sitting at right now.
Yes, but actually more recently than that, he joined us to talk about Cats.
I have no memory of this.
He did the Cats episode, and we did like three Little Women. He'd seen all of them. It was astonishing. Like, better average than most of our guests as far as actually having seen all the films we were talking about.
I know why I'd have no I know why I have no memory of it.
Why is that?
Because it happened in late December when I was exhausted, because that's what I am in late December.
Sure.
It happened mere moments before I started getting sick with a variety of things, and then the pandemic hit.
Yes.
My mind just wiped.
Well, it was the thing that happened. Anyway, he's back.
I would like to describe our friend and neighbor, Gary Cotti.
Okay.
He's about 5'11". Is that right? I got it. He works in television.
Yes.
As an assistant director at various television programs.
One notable actor notably described his cerulean blue eyes.
Was that a notable actor?
He has some notes.
I'm getting a head shake no from
I have some notes for him.
You do. Is weird. I mean, okay, so normally we have film critics, fellow film critics on the show.
Sure, yes.
Every once in a while, we have someone who is not a film critic who we just like. And we just like Gary Cotti. But the weird thing about him is that that actor, who is not really all that notable, is right. You can see Gary Cotti's blue eyes across a room.
It's true.
It's really strange.
We're just painting a picture for the podcast audience.
Yeah. So here he is, friend and neighbor Gary Cotti.
Hello.
Hello, it's me, the world's greatest dinner party guest, Gary Cotti. Thank you for having me. I won't take up too much of your time.
We're here to argue.
He's
here for a rebuttal.
We're here to do a podcast of my behavior.
Before we talk about the week's films, which include the documentary about Rita Moreno called Rita Moreno...
Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It.
Thank you, because I always forget that the post-colon title. The Sparks Brothers.
Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It.
Luca.
Just a sea monster who decided to go for it.
Port Authority.
I got nothing.
But let's begin with arguing.
Yes.
Gary Cotti has a rebuttal. I recently described, for anybody who's just, you know, hearing for the first time.
Yes.
About this situation.
You guys went to go see A Quiet Place Part 2.
It goes deeper than that. Oh. I have gone to many, many films with Gary Cotti over the years.
Which one was your favorite to go with me to? I know the answer, and it will come up later in my rebuttal.
I know.
Please continue.
I forget the name of it, but it starred Nicole Kidman.
It sure did, pal.
Someone else.
Well, Colin Firth.
Colin Firth and some guy whose last name is Strong. I just looked it up.
Before I go to sleep, Mark Strong.
Before I go to sleep, that's correct.
Yeah.
Which William Bibbiani described as the amazing prequel to the movie I Go to Sleep.
I think the very first time I realized what kind of cinema...
Great friend I was.
What kind of cinema companion he would be was when we saw a Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. And we sat in front of a very well-known film critic.
Mm-hmm.
Not Leonard. But
by the way, what year did that come out?
2000.
It's been a while. It was third in the series.
Yeah. We had probably only known each other a year or less.
But I remember seeing that with you and thinking, oh, he's that kind of movie-going person. Like, reactive. Loud reactions. And I thought, how do I feel about this? Answer, in general, I don't like it.
Was the fancy film critic annoyed that you were disrupting the quiet subtleties of Tokyo Drift?
I remember turning to friend and neighbor Gary Cotty and saying, "Shh, this is a press screening," and kind of motioning like there's someone behind us that we don't want to screw around with.
I see.
And to Gary Cotty's credit, he did not care.
I was just excited to have a new friend.
Now, I'm not saying the film critic didn't care. Gary Cotty didn't care.
No, I got it.
And so from that moment on, I thought, all right, well, if I choose to go to a movie with Gary Cotty, I know what's going to happen. And some days I'll be into it. Some days I won't be into it. But we're going to keep on going to the movies together because he's Mr. Entertainment. And then I realized what he was like in a horror movie. And I had to kind of make a whole new batch of decisions about that because you're allowed to react loudly in a horror movie. And he does. And so sometimes that worked for me and sometimes that didn't work for me.
You had to make the Gremlins 2 of decisions.
And yet I had to keep going with him because what a great guy.
Shut up.
How did any of this information lead to you thinking, oh, I need to take Gary to see The Assassin?
That was just for fun.
Oh, I see.
That was just to see what would happen.
An experiment in terror.
So let's get into it. Let's talk.
Yes, let's.
2 weeks ago on your podcast, you talked about A Quiet Place 2, and you said, this is the point counterpoint part of it.
Yeah, okay.
I enjoyed the movie.
Okay, you don't have to do that.
Even though I went with a wild card guest. My feelings were hurt.
You're still a wild card.
My feelings were hurt.
You're being a wild card guest right now.
I have it all written down. The phrase, even though, hurt my feelings. Okay. I enjoyed the movie, even though I went with wild card guest. And then you asked Alonzo to explain my behavior in a movie, and Alonzo said he does not want to save an idea to tell you later, and that is 100% correct. My rebuttal for that is true. Ideas are for now. Have ideas. That's how we progress as a citizenry.
Yeah.
Dave also said about some of my behavior in films that I have broken him of that. That is not true. You have broken me of nothing. I am my own person.
I lied. That was just me wishing for the future.
You were just showing off for company.
Because I will tell you what happened when we saw The Assassin. It is completely true. I turned to you in the quietest movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
So quiet that I thought my brain was going to come out of my ears. And I turned to you and I said exactly that. I have no idea what's happening. This is so quiet. I am losing my mind. Here is what you did not do. You did not hold your finger to me. You chuckled and said, just watch the movie. Therefore.
Sometimes my memory.
Yeah.
Now, Gary, was this before or after you attended a silent retreat in Hawaii?
After.
Oh, wow. And it was still too quiet for you.
It was still too quiet.
Interesting.
Also, in The Assassin, you said he whispered to me very, very quietly because the film is very quiet, which I would like to refer to as respectful behavior.
Yes.
It's not like I was just like, boom, art cinema, honk shoe. That did not happen. And I will tell you, I enjoyed The Assassin, and I think of it whenever I hear a quiet little breeze. I don't really remember much of it. I remember the last shot of him standing on a cliff, I think.
Yeah.
And it's breezy, and then the movie's over. And I thought it was lovely.
I still don't know who the lady in the mask is.
No. I would like you to think of a time that you and I went to see the Martin Scorsese movie, The Irishman, which is 4 hours long.
Right.
And we sat in the Egyptian and none of us moved.
That's correct.
Because that movie is spectacular.
That is also correct.
Yeah. I said nothing throughout that entire movie because I was blown away by it.
Right.
Even during the best scene in the movie where...
That's a fact. I gotta give you your your propers here because you... You spent an entire afternoon at the Cinematheque being extremely quiet.
And by the way, neither one of us got up to go to the bathroom during that entire movie.
That's true. Well, I knew better. Like, I knew going in, I had intentionally sort of dehydrated myself as though I were going to get on an airplane. Right. When I fly, I'm so terrified of flying that I take sleeping pills. And I don't want having to pee in the middle of a flight to wake me up out of that situation. So I don't drink a damn thing the day I'm flying until I get to my destination. And then I rehydrate.
I can't drink enough on an airplane. Like, it hurts if I start getting thirsty up there because it's terrible.
Thirsty.
I'm asleep. Doesn't matter.
I guess.
So yeah, that's what I did for the Irishman. I knew it was going to be a 4-hour movie, so I just
Scorsese's going to make that really amazing scene happen right when your bladder's.
Yeah, that scene. Yeah.
Anna Paquin's going to say her word.
Right. Or there's going to be a terrific scene where Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro are in a Howard Johnson's lobby, and they talk about which cereal they decided on.
Oh.
Incredible. Best scene in the whole movie.
Yes.
Anyway, all bets are off for all trailers. That's true. I think that's a universe. You said that about me, and I think that's a universally accepted thing. Here is a great story about that. I was at the movies. What year did Her come out?
2014.
Somewhere around that. Yeah. It was that kind of award season. I went to see it. I was at the Arclight. I was with two scientist friends that are not from L.A. We went to the movie, the trailers were playing, and the trailer for the movie Labor Day with Kate Winslet Josh Brolin came on. And so the movie is bad. I saw it with you.
It is very bad.
It's very bad.
Yeah.
And the trailer is like, all right, Kate Winslet, this could be good or whatever. And the movie, the theater is about 3/4 full. And in the trailer, it goes, this January. And half the theater of Los Angeles industry folk.
It was a press screening. Yeah.
No, it was not a press screening. This was a trailer in a movie theater.
Oh, okay.
The trailer says this January, and half the theater goes, ugh! And my two scientist friends that do not live in Los Angeles, after the movie was over, they're like, why did that happen? I was like, well. Everyone knows that they just whatever's on the dump truck gets tossed out in January, and if you're gonna make a whole like this January with like a shh with the symbols, like you're asking for half the people in LA to be like boo, blah, that movie's gonna suck, and it did.
It sure did.
So let's talk about horror movies.
You're a very easily frightened person.
I would like to start this discussion with a quote from Robert Plant from the movie The Song Remains the Same. During the moment in Stairway to Heaven where he said the forest will echo with laughter, he looked at the crowd and yelled out, does anyone remember laughter?
Is that why you keep saying that?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know where that came from, and it's been your favorite expression for the past few weeks.
I love it. Here's the thing. I just looked it up before I came over, and I typed that phrase into Google, and I found a little tidbit that when they were editing the movie, Robert Plant was like, please, please cut that out. Like, please cut that ad lib out
and
of
they
that.
Wouldn't.
They were like, no way. Everyone's going to remember that.
It's too good.
It's too good, because he's like, why did I do that? Like, you know, who knows? And, of course, the audience was like, you can do whatever you want. You're Robert Plant. Anyway. So, does anyone remember laughter? Going to the movies should be fun and enjoyable. Here's the thing. There is on the YouTube. Stop.
Okay, sure.
I'm not done.
And Dave White is the king of jump scares. Don't care.
There is a YouTube video where somebody matched up an audio recording of what it was like to be in the movie Halloween when
I've
it first
it.
Came out.
It's a wonderful clip.
And it's incredible.
Everybody should watch it.
And
yeah.
Everyone's having a great time. So here's the thing. Horror movies are supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And so being reactive in a horror movie is how it should be. Because if you're going to go to the movies and you're going to go and just be like, I hope nothing goes wrong and I don't get interrupted by anybody, including my friends, stay home. Everything's streaming. Just stay home. Or don't go with your friends. Go by yourself. Enjoy your lonely little life. Because going to the movies is fun. You know. So I want to talk specifically about A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
Because you were, once again, completely wrong. And the first Quiet Place, the three of us saw it at the Sunset Five. It was not a press screening.
Correct.
And the audience was very reactive, but the audience was doing the same thing that Alonzo and I were doing. When it was tense, we would cover our mouths,
yeah.
Which was fascinating to me.
Yeah.
So I did not scream during the first one. I put my hands over my mouth like a good person. You're allowed to yell in a horror movie.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I am taken to the correction corner here on behavior in a horror movie. It's just that, like, what makes me laugh about you in a horror movie. Well, both of you, really.
No, look, I'm terrible. I've had other critics laugh at me at press screenings because I freak out about, like, sudden car accidents, because that's the new thing now.
Oh, yeah.
The sudden T-bone.
If there's a shot of somebody, if the camera's in the passenger seat and it's on the driver and they're looking over their shoulder and backing up, they are going to get in a car.
Yeah, no, as soon as the camera's inside the car, I begin the Kegels. Like, it's just like, oh, no, do not want, and then bam, something's going to happen.
Alonzo Duralde, you in a horror movie during a jump scare, you're like, ah! And if the movie is genuinely frightening, tense, suspenseful, and you are clearly into it, and I can just feel you getting into it,
mm-hmm.
Not only are you reactive, but you start to sweat. Like, and by the end of the movie, you're like airing your T-shirt. But you still can't hold a candle to Gary Cotti's reactions in a jump scare. Now, my own situation with a jump scare is simply not because I'm better than anybody else. I had a listener once accuse me of being above it all. And that is not the case. The case is that I love horror movies, and I've seen so many of them now that if they are badly made films, you can tell when the jump scare is about to hit. You just know it's happening because the sound almost drops out to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a point of cinema history now where there's no such thing as silence in a film unless you are at the assassin. Or like that moment in one of the later Star Wars films that came out a few years ago where theaters had to actually post signs saying, there's a moment of silence in this Star Wars movie. There's nothing wrong with the sound.
Oh, yeah. Brother.
And so when a horror film, a contemporary horror film, particularly a contemporary PG-13 horror film, goes quiet, well, the cat's fixing to jump out of the closet at your face. That's what's going to happen. Yeah. Or the nun is going to come out from behind the lady and give you the nun.
I hate that nun so much.
Yeah. So, like,
in my reviews, I refer to this moment as quiet, 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 loud.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when a jump scare happens in a movie, good one or a bad one, Gary Cotti reacts with the, like you, but also physically flails. In the chair.
I also comes out
of the chair and
it's a full body response.
As I said earlier, spins around like in a Peanuts cartoon in midair.
I startle easily. It's a true thing. Now,
is there more rebuttal?
No. I'm gonna wrap it up. You guys have actual things to talk about. Yeah. I appreciate the time to be on, but I just think that we are living in an era where
no one remembers laughter.
No one remembers laughter. Thank you. Two, everyone, especially coming out of a pandemic, everyone is very interested in other people's behavior and watching what other people are doing.
Uh-huh.
And I think the movie theaters have always been a flashpoint of other people's behavior and what are other people going to ruin for me.
Right.
Well, I think movie theaters and airplanes are probably where we're closest to other people for the longest period of time.
But I think going to the movies should be fun, and this is a true fact. In the movie theater, I have never been shushed by a stranger. I have only been shushed by a stranger at a baseball game, if you can believe it.
A baseball game?
Yeah. I was on a date, so me and the date were talking during the baseball game in the bleachers, and this person was like, are you ever going to show up? Shut up. And
answer,
I was like,
no.
I was like, no.
It's baseball. There's a lot of downtime here.
The only other time I've been shushed in a public space that I can remember was at the gym by Tom Ford.
Not the Tom Ford.
Our friend named Tom Ford, who I didn't even know was there because I was singing along to Cross-Eyed and Painless by Talking Heads. And he came over and said, everyone can hear you. And I said, I don't care. Because the music's loud, everybody's grunting, who cares? And I think there's a way of reading the room. I will give you an example of this. Years ago, friends of mine were all going to the movies. We were going to see Ocean's 11. Ocean's 11 was sold out, so I couldn't get a ticket. Everyone else did. So I was like, what else is playing? So I saw Kevin Kline in Life is a House, which is one of the worst movies I have ever seen in my entire life. In that, there's a moment.
Hayden Christensen.
There's a moment in Life as a House, and everyone in the theater was like, "This is a bad movie." No one was enjoying it. At the end of the movie, or this big moment for Kevin Kline, talks about this car accident and like how many people died, and he starts listing people who died. And the woman behind me goes, "He's like, it killed this person, it killed that person." The woman behind me goes, "And a puppy. And a sad clown, and they all died." And I looked at her and I said, "Yeah, this movie sucks." So I think there's a way to read the room.
Sure.
You and I and Gray Drake had a great time at the Lion King, sitting way in the back during the computer animated remake, being like, "This is the creepiest thing we've ever seen." God. Like, I remember those moments more than I do sitting quietly in a good movie. And there was a moment where when I saw The Dark Knight Rises, I saw it with my friend Diane, and she wanted to see Magic Mike. She hated The Dark Knight Rises the entire movie. She kept turning to me and said, "I think we should have seen Magic Mike," like the whole time. So now when I see think of The Dark Knight Rises, I think of my friend Diane and how much she hated that movie and wanted to see Channing Tatum. And I was like, but Bane. The moment in Before I Go to Sleep, that was so great.
That was a good one.
Nicole Kidman has
amnesia.
And every day she wakes up, she can't remember anything. The movie is not good.
It is not.
She has Mementos disease.
She has Mementos disease.
It's not a good movie.
It's not good.
No.
But I'm not a professional film critic.
Right.
But I was able to read the room that most of the people in this movie sitting in the audience were like, "Eh." Like, they're thinking of other stuff.
Yeah.
There is an establishing shot where Nicole Kidman is standing with somebody in a park and a giant airplane goes over them, and I yelled out.
Did you yell?
I didn't yell. I sort of whisper yelled in your ear.
What did you say? I forget.
Giant airplane on the screen. She looks up at it, and I said, "What are those?"
Oh, that's right.
I'm not mistaken, I think you had to leave the room.
I now very much remember.
Because you were laughing too hard.
I was trying to keep myself together, because sitting right in front of us was yet another important film critic that I didn't want to screw around with. And
but he was amused later.
Was amused later over at the credits, because you were during the closing credits you were speaking at an open loud voice, which was fine because people are filing out of the screening room, and there goes a cement truck. Thanks, property developers, for all the good work you do in our neighborhood.
I had a teacher in college. His name was David Gatton. He made experimental films. He made them without cameras. He would like soak his film in lobster traps for a summer and then get it developed and then project it on a screen, very Stan Brakhage type stuff.
Right, right.
And his whole thing was he wanted the projector in the room when he screened his movies, because he said he didn't make silent films, he made quiet films.
Right.
And so to him, part of the soundtrack was the sound of people shifting in their sheets. People shifting in their seats. If someone's eating or drinking something, that's part of the whole thing. He even said if somebody whispers to their friend, that's part of the movie. And that has always kind of stayed with me. And that's why I think it's okay to whisper something to your friend during the movie. I think it's totally fine to do that. Now, in the screening of
if you can whisper at a proper moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know how to whisper at a proper volume, and I know how to read the room. Basically, that's my rebuttal. I know how to whisper properly, and I know how to read the room. But here's the thing. In the last screening of one of this professor's movies, I sat next to my friend Justin.
Yeah.
And it's a 25-minute film. And within the first 5 minutes, I heard a sound that sounded like a trumpet.
Right.
It sounded like, and I was like, "Well, that was a weird sound. I wonder what's going on." 5 minutes later, so now there's 20 minutes or so left in this movie. I look at my friend Justin; he's crying. He's crying so hard because he is laughing because he had farted. And he and I looked over at him, and he and I was like, and he go, he just kind of nods, and he's like, yeah, it was me. And we are sitting in the center of the theater,
right?
You know, and
adding to the soundtrack of
adding to the soundtrack. I couldn't keep it in, so now the soundtrack is these two goobers like bouncing in their seats.
Church giggles.
Your professor was happy that day, then, I guess.
We walked out of that theater. We had to run out of the theater so we could laugh loudly because we were being respectful. Now, that to me is a great cinema memory.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, like, Dave and I have had rules where, he took me to this, what turned out to be an experimental entry in the LA opera season.
Yeah.
And while there were people in the house who were lustily booing, we decided that we were going to be polite about it. And so we just punched each other in the leg for the entire running time of this bizarro performance of like Bach's Mass in D or something.
I forget. At the end of Before I Go to Sleep.
Credits are rolling.
Credits are rolling. And you said out loud.
I don't remember this, actually, so.
I'm Nicole Kidman, and I'm made of whispers and glass.
She is.
And that was loud enough, that stage whisper, for the very important film critic in front of us to turn around, and he laughed, and he said, a little respect for the medium of cinema.
Can I tell you, though? Here's the thing. I remember that. I thought that he was talking about what a bad movie this was. Mm-mm. And that the movie was not having any respect for the medium of cinema. So it turns out he was talking about me. Okay.
He was talking about you, and he was saying the movie was bad because he was saying it with full irony.
I'm sure. So in the end of Point Counterpoint, my point is... In conclusion, I am great and know what to do.
I can't disagree with you.
There you go.
On either point.
You've trampled me to death with your logic.
Thank you for my time today.
Did you watch any of the films that we're going to discuss today?
I did not.
Would you like to sit here at the microphone enjoying us speak?
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
I'm going to put my mic. You can shut my microphone off, I think is the best idea.
That's not a bad idea.
Okay, sure. Done.
Alonzo Duralde.
Dave White.
Luca.
Yes.
Is it in movie theaters?
It is in a movie theater. If you're in Los Angeles, it's at the El Capitan this week. And I would not be averse to seeing it there if I had the time. But no, for the most part, it is a direct-to-Disney Plus release. And the Wrap actually said that was a double blow to the weekend box office. Because one, there wasn't a Pixar movie in theaters to draw people in. And two, there was a Pixar movie at home to keep people from going to theaters.
Right. Now, why do we think they did this?
I couldn't tell you.
Because, you know, theatrical releases are happening
again. Yes, and everybody is so nuts with...
And this was clearly made with the intention of...
I believe so,
it's going to be in a movie theater.
Everybody's so nuts with the streaming services right now in terms of, like, their desperation to get... subscribers.
Yeah.
You know, the whole Warner Brothers, where everything all year is going to HBO Max, you know. I suspect that perhaps they liked this date, but they knew that that was going to give them all of 1 week before the four quadrant onslaught of F9.
That's true.
And so they decided, the heck with it. We'll just stream it.
Right. Why don't you talk about what happened?
Okay, so Luca is an animated film set in the mid-1950s off the coast of Italy and then eventually in an Italian village. Luca is a young sea monster. He is sort of the underwater equivalent of a shepherd, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah.
He's herding some kind of docile little fish around.
Voiced by Jacob Tremblay.
Voiced by Jacob Tremblay. His parents are very, very protective. They are played by Maya Rudolph and Jim Gaffigan. And they insist that Luca never, ever venture to the surface, that it's dangerous there, that he needs to remain hidden under the sea, hide from the boats, hide.
Yeah.
We get the feeling that his grandmother, who is voiced by the legendary Sandy Martin from Big Love. I got to do a Q&A with her once.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's in the past has ventured out, and she's a little more, you know, down with the idea of the surface world. But the parents are like, no. Nonetheless, he finds the occasional trinket, the occasional, like, you know, gramophone or other thing, and he just thinks, what's up there? What's going on? One day he meets another sea monster named Alberto. And Alberto collects a lot of human stuff, and he swims up to the sea and very boldly, once he's out of the water, turns into a human being and can walk upright. Luca decides to follow him, even though he's, you know, he knows that he's not supposed to. But even though his parents are very strong, very, very vociferous about this point, he is more and more enchanted with sunshine and walking upright and all the things that the surface world has to offer. Alberto has this tower that he lives in that's right on the sea with a bunch of gewgaws and is waiting for his father to return. And when Luca's parents find out that he's been going outside and going up to the surface, they want to send him to go live at the bottom of the sea with his uncle, who's voiced by Sacha Baron Cohen. So the boys decide they're going to run off to the nearby human village. And they try and blend in. They befriend a girl named Julia, who spends summers there, living with her father Massimo, who's a fisherman. She every year wants to win the Porto Rosso Cup, which is this like triathlon for kids, bicycling, swimming, eating pasta. But the local
jury, is it a real thing?
No,
okay. You never know.
Is a joke. Okay. The local town bully Ercole wins this every year.
Yeah.
The boys want to help her win the race because they think if they can raise enough money, they can buy a Vespa.
Right.
And if they buy a Vespa, they
that's
can
freedom.
Run off and see the yeah. world. That is their ticket to freedom. And mind you, the town of Porto Rosso really loves the idea of killing sea monsters. So they have to keep their identity secret. They have to keep from getting wet or else the jig is up. So, you know, for kids, this is like a charming story of friendship and of, you know, going out into the world and having dreams and making friends and being true to yourself. And I think for adults, this is inescapably a beautiful and haunting LGBTQ plus metaphor about
the closet,
yeah. about knowing who you are, about passing as something else, about finding the people who will accept you for the way you really are, about the people that you have to, you know, like, hide your true self around, about parents who are afraid of how the world is going to handle you because you're different. And so, yeah, I just think this movie is just gorgeous.
It is, before we get into the whole closet analogy,
mm-hmm.
It's a lovely, small Pixar film.
Yeah, apparently visually they were going for something Aardman-ish. They were
yes,
saying.
And they succeeded.
Yeah.
It is, you know, about... Yes, it's about a sea monster, so technically that makes it high concept, but...
the stakes are a race.
It is a film that is really just about, can this boy find a place where he's going to be okay?
Yeah.
That's it. There's no, you know, huge mechanism going on other than that.
Right.
So already that takes it from its, you know, grounding in the fantastical to a whole other, you know, much more
human
and intimate place. This is maybe the most intimate Pixar film that I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because Inside Out, as much as it's about one person stuff, there are a lot of mechanics at play.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yes.
The voice cast is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It looks beautiful, even though it is, you know, within that very, you know, brightly colored, you know, palette that that you expect when you see a film from Pixar, Disney. Yeah.
Jack Dylan Grazer is the voice of Alberto. He's one of the kids in Shazam, and he's one of the kids in It.
And so there are very few of the regular bells and whistles that accompany, you know, these kinds of films. So it has a lot more to offer for an adult audience that than you might normally, you know, think of when you go to something like this. I almost didn't want to watch it with you at first because I thought, I didn't watch Onward and or Forward. What was it called?
Onward.
Onward. Yeah. Yeah.
And I liked Soul, but I didn't love it.
I really liked Soul. I thought Soul was wonderful. But, you know, I just, I don't know what, well, I don't know what I hesitated about. But I sat down with you, watched it, and 20 minutes in, you said, oh, the ocean is the closet. And about 10 minutes after that, I said, oh, oh yeah, this is a coming out movie. And, you know, then we started like talking on the couch, you know, Cruella. Also, this sort of queer film for little kids. Right. This is incredibly moving, incredibly sweet, and completely unexpected. There's a reason it's dropping in June. It's so gay. There's no denying that, because you can look back at Disney animation from Little Mermaid on, even, well, frankly.
Oh, please. The even Evil before, Queen and
even
Snow
before
White
Little
on.
Mermaid. But, you know, the
Gus and Jack-Jack.
The
and
queer
Cinderella.
Readings of Disney films have always been with us.
Sure.
But you don't have to read this one. This is giving you what it wants to tell you. This is a straight-up analogy about coming out, finding acceptance.
Yeah.
And right down to the fact that, you know, these sea monsters are rainbow-colored. I mean,
yeah,
not like the gay pride flag, but they are multicolored, beautiful creatures,
right,
that terrify people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that paradox, right?
We've been driven into hiding.
Yeah. I love this movie.
Yeah. And I keep saying that Pixar movies used to be good, and why aren't we more excited about this? I'm like,
who was saying this?
Just film Twitter, you know.
Why are you listening to film Twitter?
Well, I'm not. I'm just noticing what they're saying. There have been articles written about.
I need to stop you just for a moment. Not listening to film Twitter means not knowing what they're talking about.
Well, I can't help it. I'm swimming in film Twitter.
You listen. I'm going to give you a little lesson in how to ignore everything. And
that's why you have 4 Twitter followers there.
Sometimes that's what it takes.
I'm in there with the big boys. But no, like Salon or somebody wrote some article about like, why aren't Pixar movies as good as they used to be? I'm like, I think people are underestimating.
I want to hear the actual speaking voice of the person who wrote the article, because I really want for them to have that.
It is driving me crazy that people are really underestimating this movie and not digging how gorgeous it is.
The other reviews I've read that were negative are all, so far anyway, written by what I assume to be straight guys who, you know, need a gay friend in their life to say, hey, guess what? Look at that over there.
That's me.
That thing over there. Yeah.
They need Christian Bale in Velvet Goldmine
Christian
to come
Bale.
Over and say, that's me.
Yeah, yeah. It's wonderful. Next up?
It is.
Rita Moreno.
From gay to gay adjacent.
Yeah.
Yes. So this is an American Masters PBS doc. It premiered at Sundance. It is in theaters right now, and I guess probably going to be on PBS this fall or in the spring.
Soon, yeah.
And, you know, she just turned 90 this week, I think. And in this movie, I think you see her getting ready for like her 85th birthday or something, or 88th.
Don't know.
Anyway, so, you know, she's a legend. She's an EGOT. And has this really fascinating story that I only knew sort of bits of. Like, I knew that she was Puerto Rican, and I knew that she's been around Hollywood for ages. Like, she's in Singing in the Rain, you know, and The King and I. But like, she was singing for the troops during World War II, you know. And obviously she was having to contend with a much whiter and much more racist Hollywood of the 40s, 50s, 60s that exists now. Not that Hollywood isn't white and racist now, but, you know, less so.
Somewhat
less so. And so, you know, you see this whole period of her, like, you know, having to put on what she called, you know, the makeup the color of mud to play sort of like any ethnicity they wanted to throw her way. And then just sort of, you know, kind of being one of those people who, you know, she won an Oscar and it didn't sort of like necessarily open doors for her. You know, she wins an Oscar for West Side Story, but she was still like, studios didn't know what to do with her because, you know, she was her. But, you know, she weirdly, one of the best roles she has in the decade following West Side Story, the movie doesn't talk about at all, which is Carnal Knowledge.
Right.
I don't know why that got skipped. But anyway, you know, she talks about her relationship with Marlon Brando. She talks about her marriage, which was seemingly happy, but then apparently wasn't.
Right.
And I have to say, like, we've seen so many documentaries like this year.
Yeah.
Where you can tell that the exchange of access to the person and access to like the clips and the songs and the whatever else is that you wind up getting this sort of like, you know, washed and dried and, you know, infomercial version of these people's lives. And I think this one, while obviously, yes, I'm sure she had a lot to say of like, we're talking about this, we're not talking about that.
Right.
She goes to some dark places. She talks about, you know, having suffered sexual assault. She talks about this abusive relationship with Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
You know, she even talks about her marriage not being particularly successful, despite the fact that their daughter is in the movie and, like, you know, very obviously still involved with her life. So
right.
I found it pretty frank. And just the clips are extraordinary because she's just done all the things.
She's done everything. Yeah.
She won her Emmy for The Muppet Show, and she won her Grammy for The Electric Company. So,
a lot of folks on camera here talking about her. Lin-Manuel Miranda, Morgan Freeman, Whoopi Goldberg, Eva Longoria, Justina Machado, Hector Elizondo, George Chakiris, Chita Rivera, Mitzi Gaynor, Gloria Estefan, Norman Lear.
Mm.
Folks. Lots of folks.
And they go all the way up through one Day at a Time, you know, which was a late career triumph for her.
So, you know, she's gonna live to be 106. She's gonna
she will bury us all.
She's gonna be Norman Lloyd. Like, excuse me, I'm only 102. Where's my next job?
Exactly. You know, I can still kick.
it's a lovely career overview. There's nothing formally interesting about it as a documentary.
No, it's pretty straightforward.
But you know, she's a pleasure.
And it's one where they didn't have to, like, you know, we've seen quite a few docs, which sometimes they do it great and sometimes not so much, but like they have to use animation or something to sort of bridge material that they don't have, you know, any material for. But like, she's been on camera for the last, you know, 70 years.
Right.
So like there's never a shortage of like, and here's a clip from this, and here's, you know, her in the Ritz, and, you know, that. And I mentioned this in the Breakfast All Day interview. If you want to know more about her appearance in the Ritz, which is what she won her Tony for, and which they talk about here, she also appears in the Terrence McNally documentary, which I think was also an American Masters piece. And you can watch that on Amazon Prime.
The Sparks Brothers.
Ooh.
New documentary from Edgar Wright.
Yes. And if y'all have never gone to listen to one of my other podcasts, A Film and a Movie, which we have recently ended because my co-host Daniel's going back into teaching this fall, our last episode is an interview with Edgar Wright about this very movie. So check it out.
And what a movie this is.
Oh, yeah.
This is the kind of music documentary that makes people who don't know anything about the performer think, I have to go listen to them. You know what I mean? Sparks is two brothers. Now, it is quite possible that lots of people listening to this show don't know who they are.
Yeah, that's because the movie's made that way.
Never been super famous.
Right.
They have always just existed.
Mm-hmm.
They have been making albums since the late 1960s.
Yes, they have a fervent following, but it's not a gigantic following.
They are, sorry, I take that back. Their first album came out in 1971.
Ah, okay.
But they've been musicians longer than that. So 50 years of making albums, and 50 years of everybody who listens to them going off and forming a band or becoming an artist, or, you know, it's that Velvet Underground influence where, you know, seven people bought the Velvet Underground album.
And they all formed bands.
They shared that album with seven people, and all 49 of those people formed bands. 49 different bands, you know. So, two brothers, Ron and Russell Mayle, born in Los Angeles, raised in Los Angeles in the mid-50s in a loving suburban middle-class home. Mm-hmm. Played football, surfed all summer long. They were weirdo Beach Boys.
Yeah, exactly.
But they also loved music, and they became musicians. And the 70s came along, and they were glam rocking. And no one in the United States cared, because glam didn't take over in the U.S. like it did in the U.K.
Right.
It existed, and there were successful, you know, bands, and people liked it here. But it wasn't
a phenomenon.
It wasn't an overwhelming phenomenon. So they got famous in England and other countries, but never quite got famous here. They have had approximately...
they've had 25 albums.
Yeah.
And a thing that I think is this movie does so well is that, like you said, yeah, it is for people who go in, and Wright talks about this in our interview, he made the movie so the people who walk in cold have an idea of who these people are, why they matter, and, oh, I should maybe go track down these albums or these songs or whatever. I think I might like this. But I think also, if, you know, like I was just complaining about the Carnal Knowledge not being in the Rita Moreno documentary, this is a band with 25 albums, and so they have made a movie that runs more than 2 hours long, yeah, so that he can talk about every single one of those albums, yeah, and like pause on it for a minute and be like, here's what happened with this one, and this is what they were trying to do, yeah, and this is the follow-up to that, and this, yeah, is how it charted or didn't chart or whatever, and then the next album. And it's not just this rote list, but that list does thread its way through the whole movie so that every record gets at least this moment in the spotlight to be talked about.
Not to belabor this point, but their biggest hit single in the United States was Cool Places in 1983, mm-hmm, a song they performed with Jane Wiedlin from the Go-Go's.
Right.
MTV played the living hell out of this video.
Yes.
Do you know what its chart position on the Billboard US Hot 100 was, the peak?
59.
49.
49.
Yeah, it didn't even crack the top 40. But everyone I know remembers that song and,
yeah,
loves it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it only happened because of Jane Wiedlin thinking Russell was cute and wanting to have sex with him.
Albums have been recorded for less. Also, they were in Roller Coaster.
Shout out, hang on just a second on that one. Shout out to how horny the Go-Go's were.
Oh, bless.
People forget this. People forget how bawdy and horny and like naughty in their like sense of humor and behavior.
Watch their documentary.
The Go-Go's. Yeah. And I just, they need to be respected as super rock stars of their moment.
Yes.
Well, not just of their moment. Didn't they just get put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yes, they did.
Thank God.
And also, what we were saying before about...
When will Sparks become part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
We were talking before about, you know, whether or not documentaries are sort of endorsed by the people who they're about and what they say yay and nay to. The thing about Sparks is they've always had a bit of a weirdness and a remove about them. Like, people thought they were British for a long time,
right,
because you don't really know that much about these guys off screen or off stage. And Wright kind of respects that. And so, like, you don't know anything about their personal lives by the end of this movie. You don't know if either of them ever got married, had relationships, anything. But you do know that they have this, like, amazing work ethic and, like, the world's most reputable fan base.
Yeah.
You know, I was when I saw the movie, I told Dave, look, this may be the only band that gets a documentary where they talk to Thurston Moore and Nick Hayward. Yeah. So, like, clearly both of
them and Miss Pamela and Amy Sherman Palladino, yeah, and
Flea.
And Flea. You know, it's this wild. Oh, and they recorded an album with Franz Ferdinand.
Yes. Which was a big, that was a hit, actually, yeah, or at least an indie hit.
So, like,
Jacques Tati wanted to make a movie with them and didn't. And then Leos Carax wanted to make a movie with them and did. And it's coming out this summer.
Coming out this summer. Yeah, the roller coaster scene that you brought up earlier is, I saw the film with a young friend and I was explaining the film roller coaster. And then explaining Sensor Round. Roller Coaster is a 76, 77?
75, 76, yeah.
Film about a maniac who runs around blowing up roller coasters at amusement parks. And it was presented theatrically in the then sensational gimmicky process of Sensor Round.
Yes.
A giant low-frequency bass speaker or two, yes, placed in the theater that would shake the seats. So during the film Earthquake, it would come on during the actual scenes of the earthquake. During the film Roller Coaster, it would come on during the scenes of people being on a roller coaster or the roller coaster blowing up.
Right.
And so
it's akin to what D-Box does now, but they were trying to do it to the entire theater at the same time with a giant bass speaker.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it meant it damaged a lot of theater ceilings and walls, and that's why it didn't last very
and
long.
Sparks is in the movie Roller Coaster performing at the amusement park. And when I was a little kid, I didn't even think anything of it.
Yeah.
I didn't know who they were. I was 11 or whatever. And I only later realized, oh, that's a real band. And actually someone in the documentary says that very thing. They saw the movie and they're like, oh, that's a real band. So it was there Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park.
I suppose.
Kind of. I love this film because I will say that as a person who has loved weird music my entire life, for me, Sparks is one of those bands that I always just knew was around, but I never bought an album. I only ever heard the singles, and yeah, and they're good ones. Like the number one song in Heaven,
yes,
although someone says in the film, one of the interviewees saying that it is the greatest electronic record ever made, they made it with Giorgio Moroder after they heard I Feel Love,
right,
which, let's be real, is in fact the greatest electronic record ever made.
Sorry, Sparks.
Number one song in Heaven gets to be number two or number three, depending on where you place Blue Monday.
Mm.
But, you know, and that's just me spouting off my opinions. But it's fantastic. Number one song in Heaven is such a great song, such a great record, that I defy you to listen to it and not be sort of insanely happy when it's finished. And it's kind of a long song, too. Cool Places has always been one of my favorites, but all through the 80s,
Angst in My Pants,
they had dance hits in the Cool Places, you know, I Predict, and their ironic dance hit called Music That You Can Dance To. They, you know, they always had sort of a wink with what they were doing. They were making serious music, but with a sense of humor, and that may have caused them to be less popular in the States than in Europe, because we don't like it when we think people aren't serious.
Sure.
Here, you're either a comedian or you're serious, and we don't like you to mix the two. And so these guys were making, you know, real important music with a sense of humor, with witty lyrics, with, you know, Ron Mayall always looking at the camera like, I might kill you. I might just be smirking at you.
It's funny, like his look got so iconic in Britain in the 70s that in the Wings Coming Up video, McCartney is doing him as one of several dozen characters that McCartney, yeah, is playing. And I remember watching that video as a kid, and I thought he was doing John Cleese as the Gumby on Monty Python. I didn't even know that he was doing one of the Sparks guys. This reminded me of just watching the trajectory of their career over five decades. There was Peter Bagg in Neat Stuff before Hate, even. He did a story in Neat Stuff about this musician named Zuv Groover. Mm-hmm. And the story was just a selection of like back album covers, like the backside. And you were watching this guy go from like, you know, rockabilly to psychedelia to sort of like drug crazed messiah to folky, like, you know, over the course from like 1965 to 1980. And the joke in that one was that it felt like this was a guy who was just sort of chasing every trend. And you're watching the Sparks movies and it feels like, no, these are the guys who are causing a lot of these trends. Like,
yeah,
I, you know, the, who was it? Oh, our friend Laurie Pike, who said that the genius of Madonna is that she's always the third person to do something.
Yes.
So it was like two guys in France you don't know of, and then she does it. And I think for somebody, Sparks was the two guys you didn't hear of, and then somebody else did it and had the hit with it. You know?
Right. There is so much of their DNA and influence in the world that it's hard to sort of extract them from it and wonder what would happen without them being around.
Right.
If you've never heard of them.
Which I had barely heard of them.
Go watch this. You might not even like their music. When the movie's over, you're going to hear a lot of it.
Yeah.
Never a song in its entirety, though.
Even if you're like, not for me, the music,
this
the
film
movie
is
will.
Wildly entertaining documentary about eccentric dudes who are really cool, and they make the world better.
And it's the antithesis of the usual rock doc, in that, like, you think there's going to be that moment where, oh, then they you know, become addicted to heroin, nope, and they lose all their money. Nope. No, they actually take like 6 years off to sort of regroup and refigure out their music and live off their savings.
Yeah.
Like, that's how...
Because they don't do drugs.
Yeah, that's how, like,
they live
smart and level-headed these dudes
they
are.
They live in a very sort of, like, not flashy way.
Yeah.
They go to your coffee place.
They go to my coffee place at the farmer's
market.
Market.
Every morning, apparently. Although, I'll tell you, I've been to the farmer's market 1 million times early in the morning since we've lived here. I've never seen them there.
Okay.
So... And I would have recognized
and now that they've immediately. Now that they've shown it in a movie, they may totally have to change.
Yeah, they might
their
have to change
routine,
their...
You know.
All right. So, moving on. Go see the Sparks Brothers.
Yes.
Should you go see Port Authority?
I have thoughts, but
as
you,
do I.
What do you think?
This is a film from a queer woman named Danielle Lesovitz. Mm-hmm. And it is the story of a young homeless man, age 19, 20.
Yeah.
Finn Whitehead.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Dunkirk. He's British. You see him arriving in New York from Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Grown up in foster care, abandoned by his mother, lost, has nowhere to go, goes to New York hoping that his half-sister will take him in. She's like, nope. He gets beaten up on the subway. Another guy, played by McCall Lombardi, kind of comes to his rescue, sets him up in a homeless shelter, and hooks him up with a very sketchy line of employment that feels like something between being a repo man
and extorting people who are
breaking and entering and just stealing stuff from people who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
People who are about to be evicted from their apartments. Yeah, exactly. People who are in danger of deportation, they often yell immigration when they're knocking on the doors. So he's doing this for survival money. In the meantime, he meets a house of kids who are in the
ballroom,
Kiki ballroom scene. Now, it's been over 30 years since Paris is Burning. Ballroom has changed. It's not even like you saw it on the show Pose.
Right.
If you have recently seen the documentary Kiki,
yes,
that's a much more current representation of what's happening. If you watch the film, watch the Vice TV show My House, same thing. Even if you're just watching Legendary on HBO Max, you'll get a better understanding of what's going on now. He kind of has, he has no idea what this world is, and he just stumbles into it, sees a young woman played by Lena Bloom.
Named Y.
Her name in the film is a character named Y, W-Y-E. Lena Bloom is a trans actress. And he falls for her. Complications ensue. And I'm torn about this film. This comes from a queer filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
It is immersed in the world of queer people.
Mm-hmm. And yet.
And yet, the main character is this outsider, young white guy who has to be taught, has to learn things, and has to rely on everyone else in the film to teach him the stuff.
Yes.
It centers a character who is less interesting than the other characters in the film. It is not as egregious, I think, as Roland Emmerich's Stonewall.
If that's what we're going to compare
well,
it
to. Well, no, okay, that is what we're going to compare it to.
What about Pose Season 1?
It is, for me, roughly the same.
Yeah, same here.
In that you wonder why this character is being given all the screen time.
Yes.
Why the POV is this character.
Yes.
Is the participation of Martin Scorsese in this film, did it come with notes about... Well, you know, you really need an outsider.
The audience needs to get into this outsider world.
Yeah, the audience needs an outsider character so that everyone else can explain it to the audience.
I hope not. I hope he would slap his name on when it was done. Just like, I want to support and help get out there.
It is not... Okay, did you see Adam?
No, told me about Adam. I did not see it.
Okay. Adam is offensive. Adam is an offensive movie. This one is well-meaning.
Mm-hmm. I was irritated by it.
It is well-meaning, and it is also irritating. Here's what's good, yes. I think.
Lena Bloom.
Lena Bloom is great, and I wish the entire film
had been about her.
Had been about her. Because what happens is she, every moment she's interacting with Finn Whitehead,
mm-hmm.
she is saying stuff to him like, I don't have time to hold your hand and teach you about this stuff.
Yeah.
No, I didn't tell you I was trans. You're supposed to be able to look at things in the world. You're supposed to be able to open your eyes. There's a whole scene where she just says to him, you met me at a ballroom event. Who was around you in that room? All my friends and me. Who did you think we were?
Yeah.
Who did you think I was? I do not have time to guide you and hold your hand through this. And yet, the film does that.
I was going to say.
Thing, and it's so strange.
The movie spends all this time on him conflicted and learning. Right. And bleh, it's like,
now, I did feel for this character because he is a lost young man who has been, you know, neglected and abused his entire life and needs a family and stumbles into one. It just so happens he stumbles into one where he's the only white person and everyone else is sort of like, okay, I guess you can hang around. We'll tell you stuff. And they do so kind of grudgingly, but they all do.
Do it. Yes.
And I felt like I really wanted to see this. I really wanted to see the Lena Bloom character be the
story.
Could
we just go to Oz and not have to have a Dorothy take us there? You know, it's like he's the least interesting character and he gets the most real estate. And because the narrative, the arc of the narrative is about him and his journey, it's like...
And the final scene is if I'm going to hate something about this film, if I'm going to legitimately say, oh, I hate this,
right?
It's the final scene.
Yeah, I'm not, the final scene is terrible. Beyond that, I'm not angry at this movie. I'm just like, really? In 2021, we're still making this movie?
Yeah, I was so conflicted watching it that I read an interview with the director.
What does she have to say for herself?
Before we continue with that, she describes herself as quite genderless, although she uses female pronouns.
Okay.
And describes herself as a queer woman. But right. Danielle Lesovitz was talking about using the main male character to explore ideas about masculinity. And while I get that intention, I don't think the film succeeded at that. I think the film succeeded at, like we were just saying, handholding.
Yeah.
And I know that everyone is not you and me.
Right.
We are old-timey queers. We know things.
Sure.
Based on just having lived among a variety of queer people in our life. So, does the world need more handholding? I want to say no. I want to say let trans people and non-binary people tell their own stories.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to tell a story about a trans person or a non-binary person and you are not that yourself, then...
Center.
Then let them be the focus.
Yeah.
Like the entire focus.
Yeah. The issue of like straight cis men who fall in love with trans women has been explored on Transparent, for instance.
Yes.
Always in a way that centers the trans characters, yeah. I think.
And like I said, even though Lena Bloom's character does, you know, she has...
agency
and you know, the self-esteem and the self-awareness to know that she doesn't have to put up with him.
Right.
The film
puts up
keeps putting up with him. And it's got me all tied up in knots.
Yeah, this feels like a missed opportunity, but I will be curious to see, you know, what Danielle Lesovitz does in the future, because there are things in this movie that work. There, you know,
I like that naturalistic, gritty indie film,
definitely going on
and
here.
That's what's happening.
This is a very, you know, stripped down New York, and they do spend quite a bit of time at Port Authority, you know. So like I want to see what else she's got, but this was a disappointment. What's your DVD pick this week?
It ain't on DVD.
Okay.
Okay, y'all. In the 1970s, there was a Canadian filmmaker. His name was David Sechter.
Yes.
S-E-C-T-E-R. Before I continue telling you about David Sechter and this wild movie that he made, I need to give a shout out to Bibbs and Michelle.
Yes.
Because they are the ones who brought this to my attention. The three of us are in a nonstop group text. And Michelle texted me one morning about 5 days ago and said, you have to watch a movie on YouTube called Feeling Up. F-E-E-L-I-N apostrophe. Feeling Up.
Wait, before you get to it, I want to give a little backstory on Sechter just a bit.
Well, I'm getting there.
Okay, then go ahead.
David Sechter directed this film that is not called Feeling Up.
No.
The name of the film is Getting Together. I'll explain why, the difference, in a moment. He was at film school with David Cronenberg. David Sechter made a queer film in the early 70s called Winter Kept Us Warm.
Mid-60s, I thought.
Oh, it was mid-60s?
Yeah, 1965.
Sorry, I got my dates wrong. Oh, I'm sorry. Getting Together is mid-70s.
Right.
Winter Kept Us Warm is mid-60s. David Cronenberg knew about this project and said, oh, you mean you can just make a movie? Literally, there would be no David Cronenberg without David Sector, his friend, who made a movie with all their friends.
Yeah, I mean, you have in Canada. You have to bear in mind that Canadian cinema was not really a thing yet. Like, they're generally considered to be sort of the breakthrough Canadian feature was a movie called Going Down the Road from like 71, I think, and The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz early in the 70s. As a Canadian friend of mine says, the real dawn of Canadian cinema was A Place to Stand.
We've talked about it so many times.
The Academy Award winning movie made for the Montreal Expo, I think. Anyway, yeah. So Winter Made Us Warm, you know, sort of seminal early queer film and inspirational film for David Cronenberg. So then this guy turns around and makes Getting Together, which I have not seen, but you've described it very vividly.
Oh, I'm going to watch it again with you.
Okay.
So Bibbs and Michelle text me about this. Go watch Feeling Up on YouTube right now.
Right.
It turns out that Getting Together, that was released in 1976, barely, was repackaged in the 80s as a VHS teen sex comedy.
Yes.
Called Feeling Up.
By Troma.
Yeah.
And I saw the
Feeling kids Up. On the cover of the VHS box are not in the film.
No.
The film is not about teens or at all. It's about people in their 20s in the Manhattan in the 70s who are discovering free love.
Yeah. Polyamory.
And polyamory and their own queerness and group marriage. And it's so wild. It is predicated on, of all things, a 1975 porn parody of Hal Ashby's shampoo called Blow Dry. Blow Dry is available to be seen on the internet in its entirety for free on the porn site X Hamster.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So, if you go back and watch Blow Dry, I did, after watching Getting Together, you will notice that the cast of Blow Dry resembles the cast of Getting Together. They're not the same cast.
Mm-hmm.
They're just people who all look kind of the same. And you think, did David Sector and all of his friends all sort of look like these folks? Because David Sector was part of an experimental filmmaking group and polyamorous commune. And they made Blow Dry. The characters in Getting Together make their own porn movie,
mm-hmm.
and it bonds them all so much that they all form a group marriage. They even bring in a sex therapist, a professional sex therapist, who thinks they're all so free and enlightened that she becomes part of their group marriage. She's got a little kid. Then everyone starts making babies within the six-person group marriage. Fast forward to the 80s, which is still the total 70s, but with video phones.
Right.
And the kids are now teenagers, and they've got a band. And they write a song called Getting Together. They perform it on the rooftop. This movie starts out as softcore wildness and wacky melee comedy of people like chasing each other everywhere, like the cops busting in and chasing them all around, naked people stumbling over cops, and the group wedding. There are naked people at the group wedding.
Of course.
This film must be seen to be believed. It is my current favorite film. I have talked about
Pride, everybody.
I have talked about nothing but this film to Bibbs and Michelle in our text for about 6 days now. It is a multiracial, queer, polyamorous, horny, utopian, experimental comedy, softcore porn. That's also about raising kids who want to be in a band. Boy, do I love it.
Wow.
The film is called Getting Together. But on YouTube,
it's called Feelin' Up,
which is basically the only place you can see it right now. It's on its 80s VHS title, Feelin' Up.
It's funny because I remember like when I would get Variety in college and even after that, every year Troma would be like hawking the same movies at the Cannes market.
Yeah.
And one of them was always Feelin' Up. And I've seen that poster time and time again.
Wow.
And I had no idea that it was for this completely different movie with a completely different cast.
Yes.
So fascinating. All right. I will watch it. And
We're going to do an episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife about
then
this.
Then I guess I will definitely watch.
Yeah.
Okay. My DVD pick is Nobody, which is out this week, which came out earlier this year, but at a time when a lot of people weren't necessarily feeling up to going to theaters. But it is a terrific action comedy with Bob Odenkirk as somebody who seems like a very... put upon nebbish, but then when he's up against the wall, you find he's got a lot of other things going on. I don't want to give away too much. It's a movie best enjoyed the less you know going in, but it is smart and fun. It's from the John Wick folks, and I think one of the most entertaining films of this year so far.
It's really violent.
Yeah.
So, you know.
There
mark,
is that.
It's your mark of quality right there.
There you go. All right. Well,
we're done.
Thanks everybody for listening. Friend the neighbor, Gary Cotty, thanks again for being here.
Thank you for my time. You can find me online at Kylie Minogue.
Please check out my other podcasts, Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network, Breakfast All Day, and I do appear Mondays on Deck the Hallmark. Oh, speaking of Deck the Hallmark, so I have collaborated with those gents on a book called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. And they're doing a special promotion for pre-sales this coming weekend. Friday, June 25th, is Leon Day.
No, it's not.
It is. It's becoming a thing, Dave. You can't fight the feeling.
I am fighting the feeling, and I don't want this to be a thing.
Leon Day.
I want you to have a lot of pre-sales for the book, but I don't want to know anything about a Leon.
Leon Day is June 25th. It's the midway point of the year between Christmas. Between Christmas and the next Christmas.
If you play Christmas backwards.
If you play Noel, if you say Noel backwards, it's Leon.
If you play Noel backwards, it's Leon.
So it's a day that has been
isn't that adorable?
It's a day that has been marked as, you know, maybe if you're a crafter, you know, if you're going to crochet a tree skirt or something, you know, now's the time to start planning that. Now's the time to start planning your gift giving, perhaps, or your budgeting. Now might be a good time to make a donation to a charity that you only support at Christmas time. Anyway, we're also, June 25th is when Christmas in July starts on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, for those who care. Anyway,
another guillotine hanging over my head.
We are marking the occasion by having, you can now order I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies for pre-sale pretty much wherever you get books. But the guys at Deck the Hallmark are making a very special deal, which is if you send your receipt to hello@deckthehallmark.com showing that you pre-ordered the book between June 25th and Sunday, June 27th, they will do a live Facebook thing on the night of the 27th where they eat one sugar cookie for each book pre-sold.
They're going to throw up.
Well, I'm hoping they're very small cookies. But,
I'm hoping they throw up.
We should be so lucky. Yeah, if they throw, that means that this promotion worked really well. So anyway, if you're planning on picking up I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, order it this weekend. And
there is nothing more funny than throw up.
Sure. And send your receipt to hello@deckthehallmark.com. Check out our friends on the internet, Bibbs and Whitney, over at the Critically Acclaimed Network. I'm sure they'll be talking about getting together soon at some point
Listen, this is a full court press.
Yes, clearly.
We're not going to rest until...
Y'all are out to, like,
until there's an Outfest Legacy project for this movie.
They should track down a print. I hope they
this
do.
This guy's a queer pioneer.
Indeed he is.
Of extreme wildness.
He is important. Check out The Schmoes Know, Dennis, anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Sewers of Paris, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Workroom, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us on social media at Linoleum Cast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts or pretty much any place where you get your episodes. And leave us a positive review if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Apple Podcasts. We will read it on the show. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can find his stuff at bandcamp.com/Blue, BLEU. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Have a good week, everybody. We'll catch you next time. And until then,
goodbye.